I'd like to welcome you to the Austrian Circle. This is the program where we talk about the economics of freedom here on WHUS Stores 91.7 FM. So thank you so much for tuning into my show this morning. We are going to be talking about the Ammon and Clive Bundy case on the show today. This happened a little while ago. This was over in the new year of 2016. And what happened was the ranchers were protesting stuff that the federal government was doing and ended up taking over a federal facility out there. And I believe are still actually there holding on to the facility. So there's a power struggle over the property that the ranchers have seized. Now, this story has some history to it. It's not just that they took over a federal building. In 2014, the Bureau of Land Management threatened to seize their cattle and seize their land from them, and they put up an armed resistance. Not that any shots were fired, but they went to their land with guns and made sure that the federal government could not steal their cattle from them. And even earlier than that, the Bureau of Land Management, of which the dispute is really the major problem with it, between these two entities, the Bureau of Land Management has made lots of claims about their land and how they're not taking care of the turtles on the land and stuff like that, even though the Bureau of Land Management destroyed a lot of the turtle habitats with all their big vehicles and stuff that they were driving onto the property to try and seize the cattle with. I think it's important to pause here and talk about the federal government owning land in the West. They own massive, large swaths of land out in that area. And Ryan McMacken's going to talk a little bit about what's going on in the West in terms of federal land holding. This article is called Oregon and the Problem of Federal Lands, and it was posted on Mises.Canada. When you own 28% of all the land, 640 million acres in the United States, you're likely to end up with some neighbors who don't care for how you do business. This past weekend, a group of armed protesters took over a federal building in rural Oregon in protest over the jailing of two ranchers who have been feuding with federal officials for years over the use of land and the use of controlled burns in rural areas. The two ranchers, Dwight and Stephen Hammond, were sentenced on October 7th to 5 years in prison for arson. The Hammonds had initially been sentenced to much shorter terms, but the U.S. government, always enthusiastic in its drive to put people in cages for long periods of time, demanded that the Hammonds serve 5 years each. It's difficult to see why monetary restitution and fines could not simply be employed in this case, but in the United States, lengthy prison sentences are seen as a solution to a nearly endless list of infractions. Now, I just want to pause here and mention, since I do know a lot about this case, that the damage that the Hammonds caused through their control burning did spread into federal property, but actually enhanced the property of the federal government by $100. It was estimated that rather than detracting from the property, the burn that ended up going into federal land actually increased the value of their land by $100 because it got rid of the brush, it got rid of all the stuff that was causing a problem in that land. So in fact, the Hammonds did not destroy things, but they were being called up on a anti-terrorism law and saying that anybody who burns any portion of federal property, whether it be a building, whether it be a forest or anything like that, that they would serve a minimum of 5 years in jail. And this is one of the major conflicts of this case that we are seeing playing out right now. So Ryan McMacken continues. A detailed reading of the facts in the matter do indeed suggest that the Hammonds were capricious in their setting of fires and may have endangered the lives of firefighters on neighboring lands. But given that no one was injured, a 5-year prison sentence should raise the eyebrows of anyone who possesses a sense of proportionality. Even more disturbing is the fact that the Hammonds were prosecuted using a 1996 anti-terrorism law, even though the fire obviously had nothing at all to do with terrorism. notes Think Progress. Quote, the federal anti-terrorism law that prosecutors use to punish the fires includes mandatory minimum sentences of 5 years for fires that damage public property but cause no injury or death. After a series of appeals, the Hammonds were resentenced in October of 2015 to the full 5 years required by that 1990s statute. This is a helpful demonstration of how law is justified on grounds of going after terrorists or mobsters, i.e. the RICO Act, are eventually turned against ordinary people who commit ordinary legal infractions. While the event that touched off the current standoff was the imprisonment of the Hammonds, the issue stems from a larger issue of use of federal lands, and in many ways the current conflict harks back to 2014's Bundy Ranch standoff, precipitated by the Bundy family's refusal to pay federal grazing fees. Though those who have been around a while may recall that both cases are reminiscent of the so-called Sagebrush Rebellion of the 1970s and 1980s. There is always the temptation to immediately side with whomever it is that's on the receiving end of the federal government's heavy-handed court system and regulatory state. However, in none of these cases have the private sector ranchers been advocating for anything we might call free markets. Indeed, the federal grazing programs have long been a subsidy scheme for a small number of favored ranchers. We often hear about grazing fees as if there were some kind of ordinary market transaction going on between ranchers and federal land bureaucrats. But this is hardly an apt description of what's going on. In fact, federal grazing fees have virtually nothing at all to do with any functioning marketplace, and we can see this in the fact that fees have been essentially unchanged since 1978. In this research paper from the early 1990s, the author notes that federal law set the federal grazing rate at $1.23 per animal unit month. This rate has hardly changed since then. As of early 2013, the Bureau of Land Management and the Forest Service were charging $1.35 per AUM. That's an increase of 9.7% over more than 30 years. How much have actual market rates for commercial real estate and animal feed increased since 1978? I'm going to guess it's more than 9%. If we look at the CPI, for example, we find it has increased about 238% between 1978 and 2013. Ranchers who use federal lands are getting an excellent deal. They are getting such a good deal, in fact, that we might say that they are being subsidized by everyone else. After all, it's considerably cheaper to lease grazing land from the Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management than anyone else. Influential ranchers are well aware of the advantages of federal control of grazing lands. This is why many ranchers have opposed state-level efforts to have state agencies take over federal lands. The Miscellanean reported in September 2014, quote, the U.S. Bureau of Land Management manages 7.8 million acres of land in Montana, and all but a few hundred thousand acres are leased for grazing at the incredibly low rate of $1.34 for enough forage to feed an animal for a month. The U.S. Forest Service also leases grazing land for the same low price. Montana also leases grazing land using the same forage formula, but the state charges no less than $11.41, with the possibility of the price being driven higher by competitive bidding. The price difference between the state and federal government, as well as the differences in leasing terms, has ranchers pulling back on the reins as Republicans, who have made a state takeover of federal lands part of their party platform, ride ahead. And Montana's grazing prices are relatively cheap. KCET reports that a 2005 GAO study found that rancher-friendly Texas was charging $150 per AUM on some of its state lands. Unlike the federal government, private landowners and most states have to balance their budgets most of the time, which leads to higher lease rates all around. The rock-bottom lease rates mean that the federal government runs at a loss. According to the CRS, quote, BLM and the FS typically spend far more managing their grazing programs than they collect in grazing fees. For example, GAO determined that in fiscal year of 2004, the agency spent about $132.5 million on grazing management, comprised of $58.3 million for the BLM and $74.2 million for the FS. These figures include expenditures for direct costs, such as managing permits, as well as indirect costs, such as personnel. The agencies collected $17.5 million, comprised of $11.8 million in BLM receipts and $5.7 million in FS receipts. However, it's hard to claim that securing a federal grazing lease is not a bargain for the rancher. This is especially true when we consider that the leases are not sensitive to upbidding from other ranchers. That is, ranchers who currently hold 10-year federal leases do not have to compete with other ranchers to renew their lease. In the real world, and in the world of state-level and private sector grazing, people who want to lease lands must compete with others who might bid up the price of the lands in question. This is not the case with the BLS and Forest Service lands, which shield the current holder of the lease from competition. Thus, it should surprise no one when powerful ranchers become concerned about possible privatization of lands or state takeovers of federal lands. But why do we keep hearing about these perennial conflicts with the federal land management bureaucrats? Well, the answer might lie in the fact that the federal government owns so many acres in the western states. The federal government owns a majority of the land in five U.S. states, and the current standoff is taking place in a state where the federal government owns nearly 53% of all land. And only a tiny portion of this goes to national defense agencies. Of the 640 million acres owned by the federal government, only 14 million of these acres are administered by the Department of Defense. Nearly all of these lands are administered by agencies dedicated to wildlife, forestry, and other natural resource management. Thus, it should be no surprise when we hear that, yet again, some ranchers are having problems with the nation's largest landowner, the federal government. The federal government likes to pretend that federal land belongs to all of us and that they are your national forests. But of course, they are not yours or ours at all. The fact that federal lands were closed with armed guards stationed at the entrances during the last government shutdown tells you all you need to know about whether or not these lands belong to you. As Alana Mercer recently noted, the public cannot own property at all. Quote, the public is an abstraction. In logic, an abstraction cannot possess property. To borrow from libertarian political philosopher Murray Rothbard, there is no existing entity called society. There are only interacting individuals. To say that society should own property in common is essentially to say that government bureaucrats should own property, in our case, at the expense of the dispossessed homesteader. On the other hand, it's best not to jump to conclusions about who the homesteaders are. During the Bundy standoff, many advocates for free markets were claiming that the Bundy family had homesteaded the disputed land and that it should be handed over to them. Given the realities of federal grazing leases, however, this is not at all clear. Given that the Bundys did not have to compete with other ranchers for leases and that they were likely leasing at below market rates or a subsidized price, it is not at all clear that the Bundys would in fact be the rightful owners in an unhampered market. The details of the Hammond case are still coming out, but if the Hammonds have been enjoying a similar deal to that of the Bundys, it's unclear as to why the protesters, who are occupying a building that they have obviously not homesteaded, should get a free pass with principled free market advocates. In cases like these, we often find that the resistance to federal control is just a desire to trade in federal bureaucrats for more local bureaucrats who are on friendlier terms with the ranchers in question, and more open to their demands for continued subsidies. As I've noted in the past, a decentralization of land ownership down to more localized levels is a good thing. There's nothing special about the state level, though, and while moving to state-level public lands is a step in the right direction, it is only that. For example, free market critics of those who want to reduce the extent of federal lands often correctly point out that anti-federal activists aren't really for private ownership. They just want state control instead of federal control. One might ask, what's so special about state lands? It's a fair question, and the answer should not lie in mindless appeals to the U.S. Constitution, but in the fact that state governments are closer to the people, more likely to respond to local concerns, and more responsible to the people who are actually affected by how government-owned lands are used. And yes, there's nothing magic about the state level. If political realities did not preclude it, public lands, such as national parks, should be further decentralized to become county parks or even lands owned by even more local entities, such as private homeowner associations and municipalities. The city of Denver, for example, owns 14,000 acres or 22 square miles of land outside the city limits as a part of a system of mountain parks for the use of Denver taxpayers. If one has a problem with how these lands are used, it's a lot cheaper and easier to take a trip to City Hall and get a meeting with council members than it is to hire a D.C. lobbyist to influence a Senate full of multimillionaires 2,000 miles away. The public is indeed an abstraction, and it becomes more of an abstraction the larger the public gets. Any sort of communal ownership, whether it's a local government or a greenbelt owned by a homeowners association, comes with its own set of problems. But the worst possible model of all may be a block of 600 million acres controlled by a set of unaccountable bureaucrats living far away from the lands they control. There is indeed a big problem with the status quo. Will rushing to the aid of freeloading and negligent ranchers change anything for the better? It's unlikely. That article was by Ryan McMacken. It was posted on Mises Canada. It's talking about the Oregon, the federal lands, and the ranchers out there. Did you notice how they are benefiting immensely from the government ownership of these lands? They certainly aren't arguing that the federal government should not own these lands necessarily, because they benefit immensely. Any private ownership of that land would lead to much higher prices, which is what a normal market would do. It would appraise the value of the land and say, this is valuable to these people to utilize that land in a particular way at this rate. The customer is willing to pay for their product at this particular rate, and therefore prices are allocated towards the most highest value use of particular land. But in the case when the federal government owns this land, it just arbitrarily gives contracts to people who may not actually be using that land in the best possible way that they can. Because once you have to actually pay the market price, then other people are going to bid for that resource and try and wrestle it from you so that they can then use that land or that resource to serve the customer. And so prices are constantly being bid up and down in a free market. And this is what Mises called catalactics, which is the formation of prices based on choices that people are making in the market economy. So I'd like to move on and read another portion of this drama out in Oregon, where one Robert Lavoie Vinicum was shot during a standoff with police. During this whole episode, so stuff that's been unfolding in Oregon, this guy was shot. And so we're going to talk about that with William Norman Grigg, who talks about it in his article, Tyranny, Defiance, and the Death of Lavoie Vinicum. Lavoie Vinicum, who was shot at a roadblock by Oregon state troopers and left to bleed to death in the snow, was not a violent criminal. He and his colleagues from the group calling itself Citizens for Constitutional Freedom were traveling to John Day, Oregon, to organize political resistance to federal control over lands in the western United States. After trying to run the roadblock, Vinicum plowed his vehicle into a snowbank. He exited with his hands in the air, staggering in the snow before making a motion with his right hand that the FBI claims was an effort to grab a handgun. Another possibility is that Finnicum, after, as some witnesses claim, was shot while his hands were raised in a posture of surrender, and that his subsequent movements were involuntary. The carefully planned ambush, which displayed detailed intelligence regarding the plans of Finnicum and his friends, was a joint operation between the FBI and the Oregon State Police. It was not carried out in defense of persons or property, but to enforce the will of those in control of the regime. Finnicum, a 55-year-old rancher from Arizona, had become the subject of a federal warrant after renouncing his grazing contract with the Washington-based usurpers, who control range lands in that state. The night before he was killed in Oregon's Highway 395 in an FBI-orchestrated ambush, Finnicum had denounced the escalation he had seen on the part of the federal government officials seeking to end the CCF's occupation of the Malheur National Refuge. On several previous occasions, Finnicum, who had raised cattle and scores of foster children, made it clear that he would rather die than spend the balance of his life immured in a government cage. Reasonable people can contend that the occupation was an imprudent provocation. That criticism can apply with equal validity to many similarly imprudent acts carried out by idealistic but obnoxious men during the 1760s and 1770s, and now celebrated in sanitized form by inmates of the government-operated school system. Many of the same people who numbly absorb annual recitations of Patrick Henry's oration at the Old South Church will see Finnicum as a fanatic who committed suicide by cop, rather than someone for whom "give me liberty or give me death" was a credo rather than a cliché. After being shot multiple times, Finnicum fell on his back, but he didn't die instantly. The video captured by an FBI surveillance aircraft showed him lifting his hand imploringly and holding it up for several seconds before he lost consciousness. None of the officers on the scene approached Finnicum to disarm him and render medical assistance while there was still a chance to save his life. In the press conference that served as a debut for the FBI snuff film, Greg Bretzig, a spokesman for the American Chica, explained that potentially life-saving aid was withheld while the officers took Ammon Bundy and four others into custody. This emphasis on force protection reflects the wartime priorities of an occupying army. Fallen enemy combatants are not owed the same consideration as criminal suspects. Thus, Finnicum's mortal remains were left sprawled on the frozen ground in a posture eerily reminiscent of the body of Lakota Chief Bigfoot following the vengeful 7th Cavalry's massacre at Wounded Knee. The federal statute under which Ammon Bundy and six other members of the CCF have been charged, 18 U.S.C. Section 372, offers no protection whatsoever to the persons and property of U.S. citizens. That measure, enacted in 1861, is designed to protect officers of the federal government, including administrative personnel and other bureaucrats, as they prey upon the regime's subjects. It originally targeted actual and suspected sympathizers with the Confederacy, which in practice meant anybody who respected and defended the right of states to withdraw from the Union, even if motivated by an ignoble cause. After the Confederacy was defeated and the once voluntary Union was repurposed into a Soyuz, the same measure was frequently pressed into service during the 13-year military occupation of the South. A Justice Department memo written in 1977 noted that although this provision is more than 100 years old, it has been infrequently used. Most recorded cases have involved Internal Revenue agents whose efforts to track down tax-evading operators of illegal stills met with resistance. Those anti-bootlegger operations, significantly, continued for decades after the regime ended the exercise in authoritarian derangement called alcohol prohibition. The 1977 memo cited three cases that occurred over the previous 12 years, the latest reaching the Supreme Court in 1971. The purpose of the memo, significantly, was to provide the FBI with a legal rationale for investigating and prosecuting under the rubric of, quote, conspiracy to impede federal officers, acts that were not explicitly criminalized by other federal statutes. 16 federal tax consumers are usually stationed in the cluster of buildings in the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. They act as a salient, representing an unaccountable federal bureaucracy that has usurped local jurisdictions by seizing land that was not theirs by right or constitutional mandate. Indeed, the federal claim to the land in Harney County, Oregon, rests entirely on illegal settlement by white ranchers in violation of treaty obligations with the Paiute Indians. Unlike the peaceful protest by the CCF, the illegal occupation of what would become Harney County in the 1870s did involve violence and extensive property damage, and it was actively encouraged by the feds as a way of consolidating control over territory to which they were not entitled. The act of land larceny that was legitimized in the fashion described by St. Augustine. A government, he explained in The City of God, is simply a gang that, quote, acquires territory, establishes a base, captures cities, and subdues people, and then achieves legitimacy, quote, not by the renouncing of aggression, but by the attainment of impunity. Although the CCF did express its intention to use force in self-defense, the occupation of the vacant headquarters buildings, which would be considered trespassing if they were legitimately owned by the finable victim, was not achieved by violence. But because the action undermined the local franchise of a regime claiming a universal monopoly on violence, it was treated as an act of terrorism. In her sophomoric screed called a criminal complaint, FBI Special Agent Catherine Armstrong uses quadruple hearsay to depict the occupiers as a nest of terrorists bent on wreaking bloody havoc in Harney County. After the occupation of the refuge began, BLM was notified by a Harney County sheriff's officer that a source informed him that the group had explosives, night vision goggles, and weapons, that if they didn't get the fight they wanted out there, they would bring the fight to town. None of this was true, of course, and the conveniently anonymous source is hidden beneath redundant layers of official deniability. The only fight conducted by the CCF was a chaotic campaign to restore and defend the Constitution, as Armstrong's criminal complaint observes. This kind of seditious talk was enough to cause Harney County Sheriff Dave Ward, who displayed canine docility in doing the bidding of his federal masters, to irrigate his skivvies. The CCF quavered Ward in a January 27th press conference, have chosen to threaten and intimidate the America they profess to love. No being in whom we can find even a faint flicker of rationality could genuinely believe that anybody, let alone the entire country, was threatened and intimidated by the occupiers. But people whose position in society depends on the threat and exercise of lethal violence are intimidated by those who prepare to call their bluff. This, more than anything else, explains why Lavoie Finicum was left to die in the snow while his killers hurled flashbang grenades at the terrified survivors in his vehicle. State-inflicted death is the last argument of tyrants, particularly those who fear that defiance may become contagious. That article is by William Norman Grigg. You can read it online at his Pro Libertate blog. So I hope that you've enjoyed this. I hope that you have a great week. Take care.